And we're live with our 306th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson, at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host, Seth Law, at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. We are super excited to be back today. We have Paul joining us. Always great to talk NPM and packages and all things safety and historical records, I guess, between the two of us. But before we jump into that, Ken and I are headed next week to London. We will be teaching at Black Hat Europe, the next gen source code review, which is all things LLMs, instrumenting LLMs to actually perform source code review for you. And that starts from the basics of both what a secure code review looks like and what LLMs look like. So should be a good one. This is the Black Hat edition of kind of all of the courses and everything that Ken and I have learned over the last couple of years. So I think there are still a couple of seats available, but it is very last minute. That's a 4-day course. So there's that one. Ken, I don't think there's much else to update people on as of this moment. Is there anything else you wanted to bring up before we run through introductions and get into all the other things?
It's been 1 week since the last NPM breach that I know about anyways, the big one. So I'm really excited that Paul was you'll give him some introductions here shortly. I mean, you know, I think a lot of the folks who are in the community know Paul already, but always good to talk or do some intros. But basically for those listening, you know, there's been a whole string of NPM attacks. Paul's been on the forefront of research in this domain. Frankly, I've quoted his write-ups quite a bit. I know Seth and I have talked about his work on the podcast. He's a part of the Absolute AppSec community as well. So you can find him in the Slack and just generally basically the expert right now in all things NPM badness that's been happening. Badness, so yes. It's not goodness, it's badness. So in any case, he agreed. He was in the same time zone. Paul's normally not in the U.S., so he happens to be not only in the same time zone, but the same state as Seth this go around. So anyways, everything sort of just came together last minute. Paul agreed to do this. I really appreciate it. While you're doing
it. I was looking through, Paul, the only time that we've actually had you on the show was the show that we did in Melbourne, which it was surprising to me. Like we've talked so much that I was like, oh, right. Like we had that discussion. I know we talked about package repositories and NPM and other things, especially with Daniel down there and kind of the state of AppSec in Australia. But since then, you've been doing quite a bit, right? Like, so your head of your what is your official title now? Like, you've got your day job, and then you've got like all the NPM stuff. So, let's start there.
Yeah, I'm head of research right now at Safety, which is based in Vancouver, BC. Great, ASPM company. But yeah, you're right. I have a lot of spinning plates.
Yeah, it seems like that goes around, right? Like we all like. So you're head of research at Safety. But you've been doing all of this with Source Code Red and like all of the NPM research that's associated with, I mean, malware in the NPM ecosystem. And that's kind of where I want to start. Like we have this latest, right? The latest release and the latest research that you've just been putting out. And I want to get to that. And I definitely want your opinions on Shai-Hulud and some of the other malware that's been out there. But let's talk a little bit about how you actually got into NPM research and malware research along those lines. Like what interested you and where did that actually all begin for you? I know Ken and I have heard this story in the past, but I wanted to give our listeners the opportunity to actually get to know you a little bit.
Well, yeah, thank you for that, man. I appreciate it. How did I get involved in it? Man, that's a hard, it's like, you know, it's like saying, how do you, you know, if I could boil it down into like one sentence, I mean, you know, I started a company called SecureStack in 2018 and, you know, did not eventually make me rich. And so it no longer exists, but, that aside, you know, as part of the kind of threats we were trying to protect our customers from at SecureStack, one of the many risks were malicious packages. And, you know, and I realized really early on that there's just, there's not a lot of, you know, we, there's two types of software risk. There's the accidental vulnerabilities, you know, the OWASP top 10 stuff. And we have just an absolute enormous number of products and startups and, you know, best practices, guidelines, and all kinds of stuff from organizations like OWASP. But if you look at the malicious packages, it's just really seriously underserved by all those things. Like, you know, and a great example of that is, you know, the two main databases that we use for malicious packages are GHSA, GitHub Security Advisory, and OSV. I'm actually the lead on the OSV malicious packages team, but the those two databases were not intended for malicious packages. They started out hosting vulnerability data and then were stretched to like include malicious packages. And they, you know, they're, you know, mad props to the organizations, GitHub and OSV. I will always be heavily involved in OSV and OpenSSF, but they are not best in breed databases for malicious packages. And, you know, I saw, you know, going back years, I just saw this gap. Why do we spend so much time? And we need to, we absolutely need to spend time on the accidental vulnerabilities, right? And the OWASP top 10 and all that, right? Those are real threats. But the reality is that, you know, less than 5% of the vulnerabilities present in, you know, software packages are actually attackable. That's why reachability is a thing. Yet if you look at malicious packages, 100% of those are real threats, right? So the risks are, it's weird. We have all this stuff from accidental vulnerabilities, but not much for malicious packages.
Well, I always go back to that talk that was given at LocomocoSec. I mean, this would have been, what, 2018, about how much of our software is actually the dependencies, right? Is code that's not written specifically for your application, but is open source packages. Yeah, 98 to 99% of the code in any custom application is actually something that that developer did not write. And traditionally, it's being pulled from NPM, especially, you know, JavaScript packages, like that huge iceberg that's underneath your custom code is where the threat exists. So it, you know, it's not surprising to me that that's where the attackers look, because we got a huge blind spot. I mean, there's NPM, there's every, you know, language has their repository, their flavor. And some of them do a little bit better than others, but still it's not like we have, you're right, right? Like, we don't have OWASP. We don't have this other like huge corpus of how do you deal with this? And every package manager is doing it in a different way. Yeah. That's Adam Baldwin's talk, right, Ken? That's
what you're posting up there. Sorry. It's not very well written. So let me do this one at a time. So just to cover these real quick, because it will be real quick. So 99% of developers are using open source code. Sorry, that got truncated. That's what that's supposed to say. It's not just open source code, right? It's actually like, yeah, it's included in their application. That's AI summarizing incorrectly a little bit of that. But anyways, this is also true. 83% express concern about the security of the open source software that they use. That feels in line. And then scrolling between things. And then the last thing would be, oh gosh, I've already lost it. So there was like, oh, here we go. 58%, let me put this in, 58% believe there aren't satisfactory methods for evaluating whether or not these packages are safe. So that's, I keep saying like open source and things like that, but that's what this is all about. So to me, this paints a picture, and I'm sure to you, Paul, this is not surprising, that most applications consist of open source libraries. Most of them, most of the developers are concerned about the security of them, but don't feel like they have good ways of evaluating them.
Yeah, I want to be careful too, like, because sometimes people, you know, misconstrue what I'm saying as like, you know, open source is a threat. And the reality is that open source, you know, Seth just said it, like, is the vast majority of your source code. It's amazing. The fact that open source exists as a thing is just, uniquely altruistic and amazing. And, you know, it should be celebrated. But it's also shouldn't be surprising that there's this very small percentage of bad guys that are attacking. And that number, unfortunately, is going up. And one of the many, many plates that I spin is tracking the number of attacks and the number of malicious packages going into, for example, OSV or OSM each month. And, you know, and it's going up, and it has been going up for ages. So, yeah, I mean, open source is amazing, but also like anything out there in the open, you know, bad guys are going to attack it. And the reality is that from a malicious package perspective, we just don't have a lot of, you know, those best in breed, you know, custom purpose built tools to address this stuff. I was talking to one of the world's largest organizations yesterday, and they're using OSV, you know, as their malicious package feed, right? And while OSV is great, you know, you look, it's a binary signal. It's malicious. Well, is it a bug bounty, you know, researcher? Is it a POC? Or is this a North Korean nation state Lazarus group actor? There's, you know, there's just a huge difference there. It's not binary. And OSV and GHSA were not built to deliver that. And so I don't think our customers and, you know, the people that are building applications are well served by, you know, what's out there right now. And that's one of the reasons I'm trying to do something about it, but we'll see where it goes.
You mentioned, I'm curious, sorry, I've been kind of holding this in, reachability. You mentioned reachability and how important reachability is, right? At least not for like malicious packages, but for like ones with CVEs or whatever. And yep. You also mentioned OSV. I'm a little naive. What I had heard about OSV was that it doesn't enforce and it doesn't fix it completely, but it does allow for you to put in more details on your CVE entry that would like tell you how you would make this reachable, or like how would you import this and then what functions would you call. You can do that. But my question is like, well, A, is that true? And B, if that is true, like, do you see that in use? Is it helping at all? Or do you have any, like, do you do any work in that end of things?
The simple answer to that last question is no. Like, I mean, like, so my day job at Safety, like, Safety's got a reachability product, and so I'm in the guts of that, right? And I understand the complexity of that. But, you know, on my side work, I'm entirely focused on malicious packages, because that's just such a, you know, huge thing in and of itself. To answer your question, the earlier part, I think that if there is an OSV advisory for a particular thing, first, you can commit, you know, anybody, any person can commit to the OSV feed. And I believe there's a way for you to commit new data to an existing advisory. And I spent, you know, the vast majority of my time in the malicious packages side of OSV. And I can tell you that I've literally never seen, aside from Caleb doing it himself, I've never seen anybody adjust data in existing advisory. And that's not just shit talk OSV, it's just the model, right? And it's just the way it works. That's one of the reasons I built collaborative nature into OSM. Like, if somebody makes an advisory, like Ken, if you make an advisory in OSM, open source malware, and I come along and I look at it, like, oh, well, Ken's got the versions wrong, I can update that. And then one of the admins behind the scenes looks at that and says, oh yeah, that's actually right, Paul's update is legit, or Paul's full of shit and, you know, Ken was right to begin with, and then they can back that out. So, but that mechanism, that collaborative mechanism, that iterative nature isn't something that's built natively into GHSA or OSV, and that's something that I really wanted to tackle myself with OSM.
So your open source malicious list is actually, I have some questions there too. Is like, because I don't, you know, I don't really look for like heuristics of compromise or indicators of compromise too often, right? Other than like when it's like another NPM or whatever came out, now we have to go do some cleanup. But, you know, it's sort of like, I'm curious to walk through, and Seth, you may feel the same way. Like, what is the day-to-day for you doing this research? What does that look like? How are you doing this detection? How are you surfacing what matters? How are you, you know, or whatever you feel comfortable sharing, I guess.
No, good question. I mean, I've built a whole automation. I spend $1,200 a month in AWS for my automation to run. So basically, I look at every PyPI package. You know, I look at every NPM package. I want to expand to other ecosystems as well. You know, I'm starting to introduce Ruby gems, but you know, there's so much just in PyPI and NPM. NPM is, you know, 98.5% of it. But yeah, I mean, basically what you have to do is you have to sit there and look at every new package coming out, and then you have to look at every new iteration of every package. You know, because we've got two types of attacks. We've got what I call born malicious attacks, which is somebody's built a package to be, what, regardless of ecosystem, they've built a package to do a bad thing. Now, it might not do that bad thing in version 001, but the intent was always for it to do a bad thing, versus what you're seeing with Shai-Hulud and all these other kind of massive high impact attacks where totally legitimate packages with hundreds of millions of downloads, and bad guys get access to it via a token or whatever the case may be, and they take it over. And the trick is, and this is a really complicated thing, Ken, is that the analysis that you do behind the scenes, both statically and dynamically, is very different for those two types of things. So, you know, like the born malicious packages, the vast majority, 99.9% of the time, the NPM user is going to be less than 6 months old, right? I just pulled that number out of thin air, so I just made it up, but it's
sure, yeah.
Vast majority of the time. So, you know, I've had to build all kinds of stuff to look at little tiny signals inside of NPM users to help me understand if it's this age, if this user is this age, or if this the age, if the user has been around for years. You're looking for these tiny little signals to help you. And I've actually built a NPM library that I use internally called Reputation to do that for me. And it specifically looks at NPM users' backgrounds and helps me understand. And because this has given me signal before the bad thing happens, I want to try to be ahead of it as much as possible. And that's another answer to your question too. Something you were asking a bit earlier is like, what's my day to day? Like that big organization I was talking to yesterday, the reason they're so interested in a malicious packages mechanism, feed or whatever it is because they've been popped, right? Mm-hmm. So they want to get more proactive, right? But at the same time, they also have to have mechanisms in place for instant response and post incident, you know, kind of what they do, the actions and the automation that happens after the fact. And so those are kind of different things that you want to be able to give to people too as well. So in their case, they want to be able to take in indicator IOC data and be able to identify whether or not they've got compromise inside the organization, either on a developer's laptop, you know, because like this attack that I talked about, you know, yesterday, that's singularly focused on the developer's laptop versus Shai-Hulud and a lot of these other ones. These are GitHub Actions. These are tackling, you know, this is a lot of the CI/CD pipeline kind of attack focus. Very, very different there again. So holy shnikes, it gets complicated really quick.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're talking drive-by attacks versus targeted attacks and trying to cover everything in between, right? Like the indicators of what you're looking at in a package are going to change drastically depending on your threat profile, right? Or the threat model that you've come up with. And the large organization is going to be way different than an open source developer, and the tools that are going to be used in both those cases have to be very custom. So like having the data is one thing, but being able to act on it is something completely different. I went down the rabbit hole. I know we've talked about this quite a bit a couple of years ago, looking at PyPI data and NPM data and just the amount. So it's no surprise to me that you're spending that much just trying to automate things and trying to like just track NPM, right? Anybody that's ever tried to just track the number of packages that are in there, not even doing analysis, but just track and host what's going on in NPM, realizes what a difficult proposition and an engineering challenge that is in and of itself. Then you add the malware layers on top of that for the things that you are looking at. So let's get into it then. Like this latest one that you've pulled up. We can talk about Shai-Hulud as well and what your thoughts are on there. But let's drop that latest one. You put it into the Absolute AppSec Slack. But the blog post itself, let me drop it into the link here. Talk us through what's going on, what you've discovered there.
Yeah, cool.
Let's do it.
Let's go deep.
Yeah.
Go rabbit hole. Yeah. One of the cool things about OSM is that, you know, I've got a contact form on the website and people hit me up with all kinds of stuff. And what happened is somebody reached out and said, hey, I just got, you know, he's a software engineer. He's on, you know, one of the freelancer gig sites and he got hit up. And so this is like a slightly different variant of the typical, you know, you're a developer on LinkedIn that has some sort of crypto background. And so you're just being hammered by these fake recruiters, right? A little bit different. Yeah. This is, he's coming up to him inside of another platform, you know, whether it's Upwork or Fiverr or whatever the case may be. Say, hey, I've got some work for you. I had another developer working on this. They quit on me. Can you take a look at it? Kind of thing. And he took a look at it and his spidey sense kind of went off and he reached out, he emailed me an OSM and I took a look at it. And what it ended up being, here's a TLDR, it ended up being a new variant of the what's called the Contagious Interview Campaign, which is a North Korean DPRK Lazarus Group. It's been attributed to Lazarus Group by other organizations other than me. Attribution's always a funny thing, but there's just so much data out there about the Lazarus Group and North Korean stuff that, you know, if you get it in the zone, you can attribute it relatively easily. But it's a new version of the contagious interview attack that basically uses a function in VS Code I didn't know existed, which is a tasks.json file. So have you guys heard about, had you guys come across these tasks.json files?
I have, but I'm trying to remember why I have, and it's in my memory banks, but I don't remember exactly what the use is.
It's basically the equivalent of like a post install script in NPM. It just basically allows, you know, like Brian Fox calls it remote code execution by design. That's what this effectively is, a tasks.json file.
Yes. All right.
You and I have talked about this quite a bit. It's basically a task.json file is a file that you can set up to do all kinds of stuff. It basically, you know, can set up, you know, local, it's automation. It runs scripts. You can pull stuff, whatever you want to. And there's several parameters that you can add to the task file, including when it runs on. So this is very similar to like a GitHub action or Bitbucket pipeline where you're saying, when does this thing happen? And in the tasks.json file, you can say runs on, and then you can say folder open. And basically what then happens is that tasks.json file is going to get sourced and executed every time you open any file in the directory where that tasks.json file is. And so what the North Korean threat actors are doing is they're basically, you know, hitting this guy up and they're saying, hey, take a look at the source code. The guy opens it, hope that, you know, he hopes... The bad guys hope they open it in VS Code or they suggest opening it in VS Code. I don't know. That's beyond me. But if they do, it immediately runs the first stage infection, the installer, for what ends up being five stages of malware. There's let's see, one, two, three. There's three bash scripts, and then there's a JavaScript, the Beavertail info stealer, which is gnarly. And I've come across 18 different versions of this variant. So there's 18 different versions of Beavertail, which is a crypto stealer, you know, steals a crypto. And then at the end of Beavertail, it calls this highly obfuscated Python malware called Invisible Ferret, or nicknamed Invisible Ferret, which uses this crazy obfuscation technique where it's reverse base 64 and then zlib compressed 64 times. So it's crazy, right? And it's just evidence of the fact that what you have here is you've got a nation state that's generating most or a lot of their income from stealing crypto. And they just have dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds, probably hundreds of very smart people working on creative new ways to do this. And they came across this tasks.json file. I reached out a couple days ago to Ax Sharma and Rami McCarthy, and said, hey, have you guys come across this tasks mechanism? Because I don't want to be calling it novel, you know, if somebody else has seen it before. I've done a bunch of research. I can't find anybody else using this. But they took a look, and yeah, we couldn't find anybody else that was using it. But we did find a couple of researchers that had come up with POCs earlier this year using these tasks.json file. And sure enough, you know, the North Koreans are now just hammering this model. So I believe this task.json model is going to replace the kind of standard first infection vector, which is right now ClickFix, which is, you know, basically social engineering somebody into typing PowerShell commands into their window.
I was actually trying to, like, because I don't think WinSurf supports, but like Cursor's VS Code based, and without actually trying it, it does appear that that might actually, if it's yeah, it sounds like Cursor might actually also have task.json, so it may not just be like. Yeah,
it does, Ken. It does. Yeah. So Oasis Security is one of those researchers, and they specifically called it out in the context of Cursor because Cursor does use the task.json file.
That's like, because everybody's using some AI, right? A lot of people are using Cursor. I mean, yeah. So that actually makes a. And actually, speaking of that, Scott Goat had asked this question of, he said most. Here, I'll just put it up. Most living off the land attacks leverage functionality that were not built to be malicious. So, like, I guess this would, yeah, count as a perfect example of that. This is like definitely not meant to be malicious. So then the question becomes like, what are, you know, missing from controls to identify them? And I think that's like that's a hard question. I'm sure, because like some of these attacks used, I think like Warp and AI integrated terminals to do searches for things as well. Not this attack, but I'm saying like some of the NPM attacks.
Right.
So anyway, sorry, that's a question for you. Let me leave it up on the screen.
No, I mean, it's a good question. You know, every like malicious package detection, you know, researcher right now is adding, you know, tasks that, you know, they're adding regex right now to their automation to look for task.json files and specifically to look at for those runs on properties. Just like they're doing kind of similar things when they're looking at GitHub Actions and Bitbucket pipelines and GitLab pipelines. So it's something I did, and that's actually, honestly, that's how I found most of these. Is I just I used the path search mechanism in GitHub, and I just said path equals task.json, and then I added vercel.app because this particular campaign is using almost exclusively over 90% of the C2. And there's dozens. There's like, so far, I think I found like 15 or 16 of them, but they're all Vercel, except one. All of them except one were Vercel. But I do have to shout out to the Vercel team. When I reached out to them, which was kind of convoluted, I had to actually create a bug bounty ticket in HackerOne to get to them. But they did address it, and all those C2 endpoints are now, they're down.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah, that's fascinating stuff. Because, I mean, it's like one of the concerns that I'm, and I don't know if like this is like grounded in reality, but it does feel like this the speed of adoption for some of the like tools that come out are outpacing the ability to do anything about securing them, let alone having like North Korean or whatever hackers running these campaigns, exploiting them, and even detecting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, this goes back to the dependency of your build pipeline and your development pipeline, right? So I think about the apps that I look at, especially from a web perspective, where they have functionality that they've built in that's very developer focused, and they usually give some ability to do RCE, right, or SQL injection or whatever it is, because they want to expose that functionality. And this is the same sort of mechanism that's just being exploited. Like knowing what your developers are using and knowing what your threat points are going to be is such a difficult task, because you don't necessarily understand. Like, I mean, honestly, like how many people 6 months ago even knew that tasks.json existed, right? Like that was a thing that they needed to be worried about, right? I mean, Visual Studio's always given us this pop-up, right? Of do you trust the authors of this project? But how many people put in, no, I don't trust the authors? Yeah.
No, it'll be fine.
Yeah. It'll be fine. Let's YOLO this, right? Like that's the typical response that you get when you're looking at these. And I mean, I know I'm guilty of this too, even looking at open source security projects that are, you know, scanning things and other. I'm like, man, I need to be more careful about running these things in restricted mode. And that should probably be the default instead of the, yes, I trust the authors. And that's one of the things that you can flip. But this is just VS Code, right? Like, what other mechanisms are out there that have this same sort of functionality that we're not aware of, right?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, post-install scripts are still alive and well in NPM, and they don't appear to be doing anything about it. So happy days.
Yeah. Yeah. Happy days. They all still exist. And unless you've got some mechanism that's sitting in front of that to do the protection, and at some level, people are going to start running that through AI as well, right? Like, okay, so you've got Cursor available. Are you going to look at that code first to make sure that it doesn't have anything malicious or that possibly could be before it opens up? Is that a new module that's going to be released? I just don't know where it's going to go and what makes the most sense to put into place. Feels like we're constantly playing catch up instead of getting ahead, to your point, Paul.
Yeah, I wish I could say it's getting better, but like, and I'm not a nihilist, but I think it's getting, I know it's getting worse, right? Just the creativity, you know, that bad guys, that, you know, they can just add one new kind of function like this test.json, and they've got a whole new way to reinvigorate their campaign, right? It's, and you know, to, I can't remember which one of you guys said it earlier, but you're talking about like these new kind of functions, and we just use this, and you know, it reminds me of like this idea of like future shock from, you know, Alvin Toffler's famous book, where society implements new technologies now without understanding how the technology works. And that's absolutely the case with AI and all these other kind of tools, not just AI tools. But here's the other thing too, is that the enterprise is loath to do anything about the developer's endpoint, you know, the developer's laptop, right? And therein lies the problem. You know, Ak Sharma mentioned this on my LinkedIn post. He said, it is kind of unique that the North Koreans have like singularly focused on stealing from the developer's laptop, because they know that first they can steal whatever the developer has, they can steal what's in their house, but then they can use the access that developer has to the organization to then go and steal from the organization as well, right? So it's just this really unique, and you look at Shai Hulud, very, very different model. It's specifically going after, you know, the, and sure, yes, it's infecting the developers, but it's like focusing mostly on CI pipelines. So, you know, the enterprise needs to do more about protecting the developers' workstations. But yeah, you know, they don't want to put another agent on the developer's laptop. They've already got EDR, right? And they don't want to add another thing. So here we are.
Well, yeah, who's going to complain the most, right? Like, we've been in those enterprise accounts before, and the developer workstations are sacrosanct when it comes down to it, because they're the ones generating the code that the enterprise depends upon. And so that is where they are cesspools of old packages and old tools and automation. Yep. That's being run, builds that are happening, and alerts that are coming into any SOC, and yet it's consistently like ignored. Oh, it's just on the development environment or the development network. Oh, that'll never make it into production, because, you know, we have Fortify in place, so we should be good, right? That'll be.
Yeah, well, the AppSec team says we got Fortify in place, and then the InfoSec team says we've got CrowdStrike or SentinelOne in place. And meanwhile, the bad guys are just driving right down the middle, this huge, massive highway between, you know, what those two things can actually deliver. So, yeah, it's a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was thinking about, like, because you're talking about one control, which is like having EDR on a laptop, right? But like, something I hadn't really thought about until you guys were talking was like, if you run, like, we have a developer who runs multiple Claude code tasks and, you know, has basically, really, I mean, honestly, most, you know, modern developers now, or at least those that are allowed to use these new tools, I guess what I'm saying is they're probably generating a shitload more traffic than they ever were before. Like, that has to actually amplify the problem quite a bit for incident response. And I know it's silly that I've never thought about that until today, but I hadn't.
No, you're absolutely right. Like, what actually falls out of it? What are we exposing? I feel like we just keep making the same mistake over and over, right? Like, I know it popped up tongue in cheek on Slack recently, but MCP servers in and of themselves, like, okay, so now you have Cursor that has access to all of these MCP servers and all these data sources that's being taken over by Lazarus malware. What happens next? They're going to start actually listing out the tools using the AI that's built into that and then harvesting whatever they can. And those MCP servers, we still don't have a good handle on the protections that are built into those.
And get them still. Just, yeah. Add on and piggyback to what you're saying about we don't have a good handle on that, because Cursor itself still has a bug that they haven't fixed. And we had to disable allowing Cursor clients to connect to our MCP server because they don't understand. Like, this is where the world is with these tools. Like, just trying to do OIDC properly, doing OAuth DCR properly, like the whole handshake and get back some, like, claims and things like that. You have to do. So, like, I'll use GitHub as an example. Like, you, if you're going to use Cognito, right, for your MCP servers auth, right, and you do the OIDC connection with GitHub, at that point, they still don't fully have the spec implemented correctly, both Cognito and GitHub for doing these claims. So you can do the OAuth handshake, but you have to add in a shim to just make DCR work. Now, why would you want dynamic client registration? Because otherwise, you're stuck with a personal access token that lasts for God knows how long and has whatever amount of access. So the only way to really truly do, like, I'm going off on a tangent here, because, like, it is so frustrating just to watch clients themselves of major providers be broken and there not be support in these major like auth and auth z providers for these, like, protocols that are not brand new, right? Like, it's very frustrating. It's very nascent. We don't have a good handle on it. And we're just, like, firing these MCP servers up like crazy. And then, to your point, if a machine gets compromised and it's running that MCP server and it has those long-lived access tokens, which is what most people are doing just because of this difficulty, then you piggyback off of whatever access it has forever long it has. And yeah, you can do whatever from there. Then you can push to GitHub. You can do all kind, whatever MCP tool you have installed, right? So anyways, yeah. Sorry. This is frustrating me. So it's a tangent I'm feeling right now.
I'm glad I could be here for your to help you get that off your chest. MCP servers have kind of the same similar kind of privilege nexus that you know pipelines do, CI pipelines do, where you have source code and core intellectual property coming in contact with multiple long-lived tokens and access to different things, and that's why bad guys really love both of those areas. And the problem with MCP is, getting back to the future shock observation, everybody built one and everybody's trying to, nobody wanted to be the one that said, hey, I don't know what MCP is. So they just started downloading these things, right? And just running them willy-nilly. I found one bad guy that had just specialized in Python MCP service. So basically what they did is they just made all these malware packages that were like, I'm trying to think what some of them were, auth0-MCP, right? Dropbox MCP. And they just threw it out there, right? And they probably had a much higher rate of adoption because people were out there just trying to figure out, what is this MCP thing? I don't want to be the dummy that doesn't know what this is. So I need to, like, figure this shit out quickly. And, you know, and the bad guys took advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Meanwhile, the adoption rate of MCP servers itself, just as a side note, isn't as wonderful as people expected. I've actually had somebody tell me, and I've thought this myself. I still wonder if it's not that. I just had a conversation this morning about this. It was like, MCP servers are either going to be the API of the future, they're going to be something everybody uses, or they're just going to die off completely. And honestly, I have, ask me tomorrow and ask me the next day, and it might be different answers on which way I think it goes. Like, I don't.
Ken?
Yeah.
MCP is the new blockchain.
Ooh, ouch.
What's your phrase, Seth? About solution and search problem, something like that.
Yep. Blockchain is a solution in search of a problem. Yep. MCP servers. Yeah, I can't argue too much against that, right? Like, when I start looking at underneath the hood and I'm like, well, if I just wrote a tool that was like even an AI tool that did this same thing, I could have more control over it. That, yeah, That's kind of where I go when I'm thinking about MCP, but I'm not as, we're not using those quite to the level that anyone else is, right? Like I do run into a couple of them for clients specifically, that we're testing those out, but the lack of controls is a huge problem. I don't know. Anyway, so should we get back to, NPM? So anything else that you want to call out on this specific incident or this specific malware? I mean, it sounds like it's pretty standard, but the new novel portion of this is actually the delivery mechanism, unless I'm, missing.
No, you're right. Yeah, you're right. I pulled all the payloads all the way, even down to that crazy Python. I pulled the whole source code repo, and they built that in 23. So the backend, Invisible Ferret, has been standard since 23, right? And still popping people today. You're right. It's that first initial infection vector that they're iterating on and innovating on. And that's exactly what this is. It's just a new way for them to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is going to be a continual cat and mouse game, right? I don't know what else to say besides that, right? Or what to do. Yeah.
I wish I knew. Go ahead, Ken. Sorry.
No. Actually, I'm just going to put it in chat because this is like, to your point, like, what do we do? Like, I'm curious, NPM said, hey, I think it's December 9th. I actually got that's in my head. I don't know. Maybe it's December 9th, probably roughly around there. They said they're going to restrict using legacy tokens, right? Which I don't personally know. Like, is that going to be a positive impact for some of these attacks? Is that going to help, or are there just too many other factors where it's like, it's kind of dropping the bucket, or I don't know.
No, I think it's like the first really big tangible, thing that NPM's doing in response to these. So like long-lived tokens in the form of NPM tokens, are something they need to address, right? And they haven't. Why have they put it off? Because they know there's just going to be this huge number of people that, something's been running for years using that token, and then it's going to break on December 15th or December 9th or whenever it is here in less than 2 weeks. But I'm glad that they're doing it, and it will address some small part of these high impact account takeover style attacks. But I think people underestimate, the sheer volume and power that these, born malicious attacks have as well, because it's really easy. I mean, I do that when I teach my class, red teaming the software supply chain. I show people how easy it is to make a lookalike package. I make a lookalike package of some new thing, right? I immediately then run my downloader script to make the NPM downloads look, legitimate, right? I add all the things you need to, and suddenly within a couple hours, you've got a package that looks very, very, very compelling, but it's totally brand new, right? And malicious. And if it's in one of these spaces, crypto or MCPs, where stuff is new to begin with and people are just kind of out there shopping, it's very effective. And so I think the whole industry focuses so much on these huge, and they should, because the numbers are massive, right? Hundreds of millions and billions of downloads. We can't ignore that. That's a massive thing. But we can't ignore these other smaller, this constant fabric, this carpet of, tens of thousands of these born malicious packages that are getting better and more creative all the time. And in my DEF CON talk, I talk about the fact that one of these malicious packages was actually looked better, right? Looked more legitimate than the actual legitimate one, right? Which is not hard to do. What was that?
It says refactored, have like better code, better notes, better readme.
It wasn't the code. It was just the look and the feel of like the NPM package, the readme, contributors, and the download statistics and things like that, right? So, I was going to mention this earlier, but then it was off the record, and now we're back on the record. Jason and I were talking about yesterday.
Oh yeah.
So with this latest blog post that I did about the new version of Contagious Interview, I started seeing, because I reached out to GitHub and I reached out to Vercel to kill these things, and they started doing that. And so all of a sudden my GitHub search started getting new hits, and then I go and look at the repositories and I'd be like, but this is like 3 months old. And then I was just chatting to Jason, anyhow. I was talking to him, and then he and I kind of together came to this realization. And you know, I guess we both knew it, but we hadn't kind of said it out loud. The whole GitHub timeline is bullshit. It means nothing.
Yeah, you can skip protocol. You can just manufacture whatever you want. Timestamps. Yeah.
Yeah, the timestamps come from the Git commit, which happens locally, and you can fake that super easily. Right? I teach that in my class. And then GitHub itself doesn't tell you when something was actually pushed. So what was happening is I was running the same search and getting new results, but they looked like they were old packages because the bad guys were manufacturing these new repos and then faking the Git commits and then pushing them. And then it looks like it's 3 months old, but it's, you know, you're not actually seeing the fact that it actually just got pushed an hour ago. That's why it's now showing up in my search. And it's just kind of, I knew all those pieces individually, but when I kind of put them together in my head, I just thought the whole GitHub timeline, which we use all the time to validate the legitimacy of things, is just total, it can be totally faked.
You know what? That's actually, this brings up a good point. And I don't know if I've ever mentioned this on the podcast or to anybody or even to you, Seth. I'm not saying this because I don't know how publicly well known this is. GitHub also has for all public activity, it has a API endpoint that just streams all, like you can just, so for instance, Git, I think it's maybe like Trufflehog or GitLeaks or someone like that. If you've ever accidentally or even purposefully committed a token and you've gotten an email from one of those companies, that's why they monitor this constant, like GitHub provides this stream. You can just monitor this API. And yeah, like it just sends you events on anything you want, including like you can say, well, okay, did I see tokens in any of these commits, which is what they're doing. But yeah, I totally forgot. Like there is the search, you doing search and you know, getting back a response. And then there's just listening to their stream. And anyways, I don't know if people know about that. Maybe I can find that API endpoint while we're talking. Sorry.
I need to spend some more time looking at that API as well. Therein lies the problem is that GitHub and NPM, like their APIs are like so poorly documented. You know, they'll say, oh, you can go and find it. Well, yeah, that's fine. But I have to know where to go and look for it to find it, right? Like,
yes. Yeah, very much so. I'll see if I can't find it by the end of the podcast. But yeah, there is an endpoint that you just get a stream from GitHub, and they don't talk about it. Not a lot of people, I don't feel like, watch it or know about it. But it, yeah, it's there. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, there's a similar API. There's a similar API, Ken, that I watched just for the creation of new accounts. So I just sit there and I count how many new GitHub accounts are created every hour. And then you can just extrapolate how many new GitHub accounts are created every day, averaged across 365. And the number is big. I've done the same thing with NPM too. And that's how I found out there's 1,100 new, on average, there's 1,100 new NPM packages per day. And there's over 140,000 different modifications to packages, either new versions or deletions. And that's one of the reasons that makes it so hard for my automation and safety's automation and everybody else is doing this, is because there's just so much stuff, so yeah, moving pieces.
Well, and this I mean, this goes back to discussions that we had. I mean, this was 10 years ago, Ken, plus, that NPM at the time, and this was before, you know, when NSP was still big, before it kind of got acquired and sucked into NPM and into GitHub. But you know, it was Adam Baldwin and his crew was what, 5-6 guys. And at that point, it was only like 400 to 500 packages a day is what we were looking at, new packages a day, not even changes, just new packages a day. And even with automation and even with like manual checks, like 6 guys can't handle that, right? Like there's just so, the volume of data is so much that we've got to figure out better ways to actually protect against it. I mean, I know Scott like is tongue in cheek, right, about like using blockchain to create verifiable timelines to actually have signed packages. And I know that like GitHub has been reticent to push that direction. I like, you can as an organization set that up for your repositories, but most people won't jump through those hoops, right? We just don't see it happening. Again, you're creating gates for developers that for them to jump through when they don't choose to do that. And yeah, path of least resistance is what they'll end up using.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hesitant to blame like GitHub and NPM for certain things that are built. I mean, like Jason and I were talking about this yesterday, like, you know, GitHub catches a lot of the blame for things that are really just Git issues, like the whole Git commits and signing of identities, right? But the reality is that GitHub itself doesn't delineate between somebody that is not using GPG signed commits versus, you know, any other commit. So like there's no, you just look at it and you don't know, like there's no data there, right? So, you know, I think that GitHub could be doing more, and NPM certainly could be doing more. I mean, it's owned by the world's third largest company with a market cap of, I don't know, $3 trillion. So, you know, they could be doing a little bit more about the security of it, but you know, they want to make sure there's no resistance to creating new accounts. So, you know, and creating stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all about the NPM lock-in, vendor lock-in, right? Like, you know, you have to...
Well, I think it's hilarious now because I release all my tools now in NPM. So I'm like, I'm part of the, you know, I'm part of it, right?
Yeah.
I did find the NPI. I think I found this endpoint correctly. Anyways, I believe that's the correct endpoint. And the one thing I will say, like for GitHub, it doesn't do anything for the timestamp thing, but this is a recommendation I have for any organization is because of what you're saying, where you can like easily just impersonate anybody you want. I mean, even goes as far as like, I mean, you've seen this, we talked about it where, you know, you push a commit and if you like did it as Linus, you're going to have Linus's icon. It's going to look very legit. It's going to link to his profile, all that fun stuff. So the solution would be to enforce, require signed commits and enforce that. And then have people do signed commits. That was kind of GitHub's solution. It's just not like, it's only one thing, right? I mean, obviously it doesn't help in the other like timeline skew type things. It doesn't help. And like for NPM, obviously they're trying, but I think you're right because I'll just say this, like I did work on, yeah, I worked at GitHub. I worked with that NPM team. We've talked about it, you and I, quite a bit. We had Miles on the podcast. Like I'll admit that there could be more funding for NPM related work for sure. Now it may have changed since I haven't been there since, oh gosh, when did I leave? 3 years ago? So like, I'm sure in the last 3 years, things have changed and improved, I hope. But I don't know. I felt like NPM needed a lot more. Yeah, they felt like they need a lot more support. And like Miles even kind of said it though, too. Like Miles is kind of like, yeah, I worked like crazy hours and it was nuts. And it's like, yeah, like, because you didn't. Anyways.
I'm going to say it. You might not want to say it as a former employee of Git, but I'm going to say it. Microsoft should be spending exponentially more money on the security of NPM. It is the world's largest software registry. And it is a joke. Like in some ways it's a joke. Like I use it and I love it. And it's obviously something I talk about a lot, but the reality is that PyPI and a lot of these other smaller registries that are not owned by the world's third largest company, which are run by, you know, very small security teams that are, you know, in some cases volunteers, in some cases paid by the non-for-profit, are doing more to address these issues, these core fundamental issues, right? So I call bullshit. I'm sorry. They should be doing more. The fact that NPM still is the dumpster fire that it is, and it's getting worse, right? Because, you know, the fact that North Korean professional criminals, you know, dozens or hundreds of them or whoever, I don't know how many there are spending so much time attacking this space. And yet it doesn't feel, I mean, what do we have here that's tangibly changed? Getting rid of these long-lived tokens? Okay, cool, great. But I mean, there needs to be a lot more done here. And it just seems crazy that in 2026, because we're meeting.
So right. I will say this, like, because you said it, you mentioned like, to add to your point, you talked about, and I know some of the articles from other folks said this kind of as well. Like, these attacks are working on getting more sophisticated. They are getting better. That's talking about like improvement, right? I know you did mention North Korean hackers and whatnot. So I guess that is kind of nation state. But in my opinion, I'm like, man, if you're like truly a well-funded, well-organized, like maybe not North Korea, but maybe somewhere else, or maybe North Korea, I don't know. Like, if you're a truly well-funded, like super elite nation state attacker, like, is anyone even going to, I guess I'm saying, like, is anyone even going to detect that? Because like, you're seeing detection because like these people have made some mistakes. It's pretty easy to go and see if you, like with the Shai Lewitt attack, if you had like GitHub branches and workflows that were named that, like that's an easy indicator of compromise. So pretty, you know, big mistake, I'd say. But like, someone who's really good at this stuff, how are they? So like, that does, I think if that is true, where there are way more sophisticated attackers we're just not catching, then, and I have to say, I do agree, like Microsoft has never put in the amount of money that they should have for NPM. Then yeah, like it's pretty awful for the rest of us. Sorry, I'm reading also notes here from Scott.
Hey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. It's a good first step.
Yeah, and I'm committed to it. So like, I have gotten, I mean, many of those spinning plates. I've got a bunch of more tools. I have one that I'm releasing later this week or early next week, Malice, which is basically SCA from malicious packages. Like, I'm here for a solution, right? And I'm willing to spend my time and my energy building open source tools. Open source malware, you know, makes me no money right now, and it spends, you know, I spend a shit ton of my time on it, but I built it because we needed it, right? So I'm committed to it. It's frustrating when I'm dealing with organizations that do have these massive budgets and they don't give a shit. Like, I mean, just me turning in, you know, this yesterday's blog post, I had to reach out to Jason and Olivia and a bunch of other people that I know at the organization to say, hey, there's no way for me to turn in 38, you know, repositories and things, you know, like I can make one ticket, which I did, but none of that's been addressed. I haven't gotten any feedback yet on it, right? Like, there needs to be a better way for these organizations to work with me. I'm spending my time doing this for free. You know, it's frustrating when the organizations themselves aren't doing, you know, enough to meet that.
Yeah. I mean, that's always been the open source complaint, right? Like, these large organizations benefit from the open source community in general, and the payback is not always there for whatever reason, right? Like, whether it's just, oh, we have no way to do that, or they depend upon it, or like, they're, you know, it sucks. But this is, we appreciate it, right? Like, I see what you're doing in there, and it, you know, it gives me FOMO of, man, like, we could spend so much more time in that to actually see what's going on. And you do wish that the organizations that have those specific controls, like Microsoft, would number one, fund the research, but number two, put the controls in place that would have material effect for the community at large. And I get that there's historical reasons. I get that NPM started as, you know, something else before it was acquired, and it's a hard problem to solve. But I mean, come on, it's Microsoft and GitHub, right? Like, they have engineers that could solve these problems. So I don't know where that gap is, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, I want to take, because this got my brain thinking. When the three of us and James were at, I can't remember if it was RSA or whatever it was, but we were shit talking about vibe coding, right? And I was just like, you know, and we all went to, we've had this conversation several times. I want to say publicly that my position on this has changed.
You're vibe coding now, huh? You're vibe coding.
I'm vibe coding. Yeah. I am here to say publicly, I'm outing myself.
I can't see your breath. Yeah.
But I have to say, like, listen, the core argument that we had is still, you know, is true, in the sense that my position then was that, yeah, baby. My position then was that, you know, vibe coding is a risk, in the sense that many people can use these tools that don't have a background in security and don't understand what they're building. So that still is true. But I'll say this, like, vibe coding and tools, Claude and Lovable and other tools like that, have allowed me to take these ideas that I've thought about for years and to build them quickly in a reproducible way, right, in SCM, and deliver these functions that I've always wanted to, that I just haven't had the time to sit down and write out, because I'm not, you know, I'm not a great Python guy. But and so I did want to say publicly here, my position has changed a bit, and I, you know,
I'm with you that, like, it is a huge threat, right? Like, and it's getting bigger because of what we don't understand. But so the threat is always going to exist. It's just that the threat has changed, right? There's always a threat that there was going to be malware introduced by custom software. Vibe coding is going to get better. The results that are coming out of there are already getting better. I'm glad to see your mind can be changed, Paul, right? Like, yeah.
Seth, I might be a highly opinionated guy, but I'm also open when the landscape changes and smart people like you guys come at me with good arguments, you know, I'm certainly willing to evolve. And I hope that by publicly outing myself here that I'm coming good. I wish here's a startup idea for anybody that wants a startup idea. If you could integrate genuine CI, continuous integration, into some of these tools like Lovable, so that you're not basically going around, you know, a lot of these tools are helping people push directly to production. And therein lies, to your point, Seth, and here's a new challenge, right? Yeah. That, you know, tools like Lovable, as much as it's amazing, I love it, forgive the whatever, but it is pushing for most people directly to production, and, you know, not integrating natively with security scanning tools when it integrates with your GitHub repository and account. So, startup ideas. There you go.
Well, we talked to, and I never edited the video. I have like several different videos and audio streams I need to chop together to for the AppSec Village DEF CON panel we did. But when we did the panel afterwards, we had some big companies, like the kind of companies we've been talking about, come up, and I won't name them directly, but they came up because I had asked and Seth had asked about guardrails for like vibe coding. And there are big efforts being done right now inside. I mean, you probably already know more. I feel like you probably work with the enterprise a lot more, especially as a human to human connection, giving them advice and things like that. So you probably already heard about this, but it was new to me that people were already going out there and creating guardrails around that from a security perspective. I don't know where it goes from there. Like, I don't know what all those guardrails look like. I'd be curious, you know, but I don't know. Have you guys heard more about any of this or seen it at all? Or
no, I haven't seen it popping up. I mean, in code that I've been looking at, I'm seeing more and more guardrails like Claude MD and other prompts show up, for guardrails. That is definitely a thing, but they differ so wildly. There's no standard right now on what those what security guardrails look like in those, at least from what I've seen. And that's just a small sampling, to be honest. Like, we're not looking at code from large organizations that are generating, you know, thousands, millions of lines of code. So,
well, maybe if I'd actually read it. Answers in here. It's in here. It's on the queue. It's on the queue of books.
I mean, circling back to that earlier observation about, you know, enterprise being loath to you know, touch the developer's laptop, they're allowing developers to use a lot of these tools, and in many cases encouraging them to use these tools. But then, you know, the threat model and the attack surface changes then, because, you know, it changes the way they function in their workflow with how code gets from their laptop into a shared repository, right? And so I think because we've integrated these tools so quickly and implemented these tools so quickly, we haven't really kind of, in many cases, thought about the outcomes of this. But that's, you know, I guess that's good for us in the security space.
Yeah. We will all be employed, even though people will tell you otherwise, and that, I'll take your job.
Come at my job, AI. Come at me.
Please do my job. I go live on a farm somewhere in nature.
In nature, yeah. Well, yeah. Well, we have been going for more than an hour. I want to be cognizant of everyone's time. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today. Like, this has been you know, nihilistic at best. I don't know, like, how you want to describe it, but you know, I do feel like things are there's places for us to get better, right? And there is activity happening, and even though at times it feels like we're, you know, yeah, pushing that world up the hill, yeah, take the good bits with where you can, and we'll just keep moving forward, I guess, right?
Yeah, I agree. I think that duality is something I've always been good at, like the nihilism, but the fact that I take out these individual chunks and attack them one by one, and you know, you make progress that way. But do you guys mind if I do a shout out to Open Source Malware? Is that cool?
No, yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah, so I've built a tool, opensourcemalware.com, spelled normal, and it's effectively trying to kind of fill the gaps that OSV and, thank you, my friend, that OSV and, okay. and again, mad love to those projects. I will continue to be involved with OSV and whatnot, but I saw the need to build something that, you know, went beyond that and kind of sat on top of those foundations. And so, yeah, I built Open Source Malware and starting to take off, so I'm excited.
Cool. It's good work, right? Like sorry, Ken, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, because the answer was at the bottom. There is API documentation here, so you can just query that. The website looks amazing, but I was curious on the API side of it. Sorry, Seth. That's all.
Yep.
Yeah, there's ways. I specifically. Sorry, Seth.
Yeah. You're specifically
I specifically designed the APIs to address the issues that I've had with OSV and, you know, like the lack of the ability to do this stuff. So yeah, this was an API first thing, actual Ken.
Cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, I figured that would be the case, but at first I was kind of like, where's the API? But there's an API. So like
100%.
Yeah. Awesome.
There's even sticks.
Well, sure, you don't want to just make a server.
What was that?
On that note, again, Paul, we appreciate you, all that you do. If listeners have further questions, they can find you in Slack, right? Any other place that they should look for you specifically?
I'm pretty prolific on LinkedIn, so hit me up, Paul McCarty on LinkedIn. You can find me from there. I'm also known as 6mile, so you can, my GitHub account, 6mile, you can find me 6mile@linux.com. So yeah.
Yeah, sweet. All right.
Thanks, guys.
Well, with that, yeah, thanks so much. We'll go ahead and close it out for today. Any final thoughts, Ken?
Thanks for the listeners. But so thank you to the listeners. But man, Paul, thank you for doing this. Like, it's just so timely. So it's like, of course we always want you on, but like right now this is becoming a real situation. So it's nice to, anyways, it's nice to have you on, and I'm glad everything lined up. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. Well, I appreciate you guys individually, as well as the, you know, Absolute AppSec, ecosystem. And my kids were excited today that I was going on the podcast. So my daughter brought out, sorry, I know we're trying to hang up here, but
yeah. Oh, sweet. Yes. that's the vintage one. I don't even think I have any more of those to give away, right?
Like OG.
Yeah. We're going to do a new press here pretty quick, but it'll be a different design, I'm sure. So,
all right. Well, hook a brother up.
We will, for sure. And it'll be coming your way. So, all right. Thanks all for listening and participating. We'll see everyone within the next couple of weeks. Thanks.
See you guys.